open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Senator George, you're back beside me. It's good to good to have you close by. So, SJR 8 and SJR 3, we're still working on. Amendments are out, but we will not be moving those two bills this morning. Paul, we have two bills for committee introduction.
Yes. Mr. Chair, actually, the first LC you have is a companion to SJR 3 and SJR 8. It's LC 2618. It is the special election bill that sets a special election for May 15 of this year for those two measures that you're considering, one on the redirection of the corporate kicker into reserve fund and the other that creates a new constitutional reserve fund. Of course, one of the key pieces of that LC is the ballot title for each of the measures, and that's blank. So this would be the vehicle for you to use when you consider that. LC 2618.
You want to talk about LC 2764?
The other LC was one that really grew out of discussion with the chair and Senator Monroe when we were talking about the school distribution formula and the weighting for small schools. What this measure does, LC 2764, eliminates the weighting for small schools from the calculation for the basic grant. It's LC 2764.
Two bills just to get into play. Senator George?
Mr. Chairman, I move that, should we do one at a time? You better do it that way, or you want to accept both of them?
You can do both.
Okay, the LC 2764 and LC 2618 be accepted by the committee as, these are not committee bills, but just as...
Senator, they would be introduced as committee bills, sponsored committee by the Committee on Finance and Revenue.
Okay, that's the motion.
Thank you. Senator George has moved the introduction of Senate Bill... Our LC 2764 and LC 2618 as committee bills. Discussion. Objections to that motion? So ordered. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 66. Paul.
Mr. Chair, Mazin is our economist on Senate Bill 66. And I'm not sure where he is. Just Mazin on his way.
Well, we can, if we want to bring up, we have two of our constitutional officers. If we want to buy time, or do you want to introduce the bill and then...
I'd rather wait till Mazin gets here, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so let's talk about the amendment to these bills first. And unless this is Mazin right now, which... It is not. Welcome to our committee. So let's do that. Let's. We have the state treasurer with us. We have our secretary of state, and they are bringing an amendment that I believe Senator George may have worked with them in terms of just getting it drafted. Welcome to Senate committee. You're spending a.
This is my home away from home. Thank you. Do you want your staff to give you an overview?
If you have a moment, sure. We'll stick with the protocol and have Mazin introduce the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you for doing this to me.
You're sick.
Senate Bill 66 actually has in its own... trying to identify the and make it obvious the difference between what an investment for specifically distinct language in the statutes that will allow for investment of a fund versus the understanding that might be deduced out of the word of gaining interest for a fund, and that does not necessarily mean it is to be invested by the state treasurer by just having the word interest into the statutes. So it tries to make it explicit, and at the same time, it allows for it to get its own interest. Now we have a couple, that's the bill on its own. We have a couple amendments that are proposed at this time. Amendment, the dash two amendment. You have in front of you, it basically it takes out the community service fund and makes it the out of the general fund and allows it to be a distinct program and a distinct fund. That's the dash two that you have, and then we have a second one that is a dash three amendment. And the dash three amendment primarily takes it comes from DHS, and it it talks about taking a fund and allow the community housing trust, and this is the amount of money that came out of the sale, I think, of the damaged hospital, and allow that to be a distinct trust fund to be invested after the amendment or the bill that goes into law that allows for the investment. That fund of the damaged money trust to be allowed to be invested on its own. Those are the ones I'm not...
Good. That'll get us started, Mr. Treasurer. This is your bill. Anything
our
you want to
bill.
Say about the bill,
yes.
And then amendments.
Actually, I'll have Darren Bond come and present the rationale behind the bill and some of the amendments. I'm here actually with the Secretary of State to talk about the Dash 1 amendment, which I think Bill and I will want to make sure you understand why we're here to testify before that. This is the Dash 1, and from Bill's and my perspective, I think this is one that's a very simple bill, a simple modification. It's restoring the balance of powers between the three constitutional officers, that is the governor, Secretary of State, and my office, the State Treasurer. And we've had that balance of power since the time of statehood up until the 2005 legislative session. In the Christmas tree bill, Senate Bill 1101, passing at the last hours of session, a change in state agency, a definitional change, was made that put the Treasurer's office and Bill's office as redefined as a state agency under the governor's office and DAS. And while that may seem an innocent change, it's a substantial change in the way the state has operated, both in terms of the budgeting process, but also the powers in which Bill and I have. And we're here to ask that the Dash 1 amendments be adopted to restore that balance between the three offices. This is one where, again, some of the rationale that I've heard was it's more expeditious for LFO to potentially manage a budget and the budget process. And we did talk to them about this. There was no consideration of the issue that Bill and I are most concerned about, which is the issue of power and the separation of power between these offices. Yes, we work with the governor of the state of Oregon. The difference is we don't work for the state governor. And that really is a small difference, but a big difference, and one that, again, has served the state, and one that we believe is really important to go back and restore. So with that, I appreciate Bill letting me at least start, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary of State.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's a great pleasure to be here this morning. I'm Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State, and I'm here just to sit next to Randall and speak in favor of the Dash 1 amendments, which he described to you. I can't really add much to what Treasurer Edwards has already explained about the Dash 1 amendments, but I really do believe, as a separate constitutional office, we are accountable to the voters, and we're accountable to the legislature for our budget. You are obviously the people that have your hands on the purse strings, and we understand that. I think we realize that some of the changes that were made last session to Senate Bill, it was through Senate Bill 1101, some people view those as merely just a process issue and just simplify the budget process and make it simpler. But we really believe, I think Randall and I feel very strongly about that this is just really a major policy shift that erodes the independent authority of the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer. And it really, frankly, our budget worked fine this time, but it could have some very unintended consequences if you have some disagreements between the constitutional officers. Obviously, the Secretary of State is elected by the people and is accountable to the people. And it's really not appropriate for our budget to be under the control of another co-equal constitutional officer of the state. Basically, I guess the concern is that the governor just depends on who the governor is, and the governor could use the power of the purse for political purposes or for reprisals or whatever. I mean, we're elected independently, and we feel we're fairly protective of that. Given that the Secretary of State is constitutionally mandated to conduct audits of government programs, it's really imperative to maintain our independence. And only then can we ensure Oregonians that our priority will always be doing their business honestly and fairly. So I'm just very strongly supportive of the -1 amendments to keep our offices clearly separate constitutional offices of the state.
Thank you. Questions for our Secretary of State or State Treasurer?
We blew what?
We did. I guess the only obvious question is that as you were submitting your budget this time, it was new. You mentioned this, Bill. You didn't, this time it went smoothly, but what was the mechanics of it? You sent it up to the governor's office or to DAS? And
it went through DAS, but let me have my deputy, Jean Strait come up, because she's Ms. Budget, so she can really explain to you exactly what the process was that we followed. I have no complaints about the results of the process this year, but it could be very different.
One thing I might just add, Mr. Chair, and by the way, for the record, Randall Edwards, State Treasurer, we've always, and I think Bill the same way, have paralleled the DAS process of budgeting. It's not that we've, and many of our policies and procedures follow DAS, right. But there is an independence there that, again, that line is what we're asking to be restored. And that's, we've complied this time, but we think long-term, and this isn't about Bill and myself, this is about the long-term integrity of these offices. And just to remind the committee, the land board, which comprises of the three constitutional officers, again, doesn't mean that we would see a problem, but potentially you could see a problem. And there again, you're trying to have three independent viewpoints on matters of the state.
Sure. Yeah, Senator Monroe, and then we'll go to...
Have you two gentlemen talked to the governor about this?
We did. In fact, right after we learned about it, which took us about 4 months to find it buried in that bill, we did talk to him. And
I don't see him here, so I assume he doesn't object to your...
He does not.
He does not object, no. And did you want very briefly explain the budget process that we went through this time?
The new, yes.
Okay. For the record, my name is Jean Strait, and I'm the Deputy Secretary of State. And actually, like Treasurer Edwards said, we parallel the process with DAS. We submit our budget to BAM, Budget and Management, and we follow all their processes. The difference is that what this allows is the governor to cut packages, and then our budget does not come to the legislature as whole. In the past, the governor doesn't cut our budget, doesn't make any recommendations on our budget, and then it comes as a complete package to the legislature, and that power lies with the legislature. So there's the big difference right there.
That really sums it up right there.
So maybe rephrase, we're restoring your power.
Right.
Boy, well done. That is, we're always interested in restoring and growing our dominion.
Yes. Can I quote you on that, Mr. Church?
you got it. you got it. That's true. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Darren Bond, do you want to talk to us about the original bill, which has received less? And if there's anyone from LFO that's here, I just don't know. You're more than welcome, before we move on to the original bill, to come talk to us about the rationale. See no hands waving. Mr. Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasurer. I have the mundane part of the bill. I think all of the excitement's now gone. Senate Bill 66 is the Finance Division's housekeeping bill. It clarifies intended language, as Mazin indicated, and it eliminates some accounts from that are in the general fund that shouldn't be. Currently, statute has two conventions when it talks about the setting up accounts that retain interest. One of them simply says interest. And we believe when you say that, you're telling us that you expect it to be treated more like an interest-bearing checking account. The other convention talks about investments, and we believe that tells us that at the treasurer's discretion, should the nature and use of the funds warrant it, we could invest those monies potentially out to longer term, different instruments, but taking on some kind of additional risk as we do, and capturing additional yield that would be commensurate with that. We believe those distinctions are real. We believe they're valid and that they should exist. But recently it's been called into question whether there's truly a statutory distinction given the Treasurer's broad discretion about investing state funds. We believe, again, it's a policy decision that you should make, not the Treasurer and the agency. And this change in Section 2 of the bill will establish that distinction in statute. The remaining sections of the bill remove accounts that were established in the general fund and retain interest. Interest-bearing accounts shouldn't be in the general fund. They lose their general fund flavor as soon as we say that they have to retain interest. We have to keep segregated balances. The cash flow benefit to the general fund's not there. No income is thrown into the general fund. And, in fact, it complicates the reporting on the general fund for my staff. And so this will eliminate those remaining accounts. The dash twos catch two accounts that I missed in the drafting, and I apologize for that. The final section of the bill eliminates some archaic language that had a purpose in a paper-based world. It talks about duplicate receipts being generated by the treasurer and delivered to DAS. We don't make paper receipts. We deliver electronic records on a daily basis, but DAS doesn't want it, and we don't do it. So we're just catching the statute up with practice. That's the extent of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Mr. Bond? Just on the dash ones, your office or the Secretary of State's office has communicated with the Ways and Means chairs regarding the dash ones.
Yep, we've spoken to both of them.
Great. Other questions on the dash twos or the dash threes or the dash ones? We're getting ready here. Dash ones, dash twos, dash threes. It's feeling like a real legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anyone else on Senate Bill 66?
Mr. Chair, because we didn't talk about the dash one at the time, dash one, the primary function of it, as described by Secretary of State and State Treasurer, deletes the ORS 291.230, which defines a state agency, and in that process it puts their offices into a state agency definition. However, that is also have excluded the legislative assembly from that definition before. And just to mention a couple of accounts on the Senate bill itself and the dash, the other dashes, it's mobile home parks account and of the housing, and then the oil spillage control fund. And these are the small accounts that are being removed out of the general fund and into their own entity.
Good.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Senator. I just want to make sure I understand this bill. Edwards invests money. Some of that money is in segregated accounts, but this bill allows him to invest that basically in block. You don't have to have separate investments for the segregated accounts, but the interest still would accrue to whatever fund is, you know, is being invested. Is that more or less it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, we invest everything.
Yeah.
The difference is that the bulk of all of the state's working capital is invested through what we call the Oregon Short-Term Fund, big money market-like mutual fund type of vehicle, and we pay interest out of that to accounts. That's the interest accounts. If you say we can invest it, that would give us the option, not the mandate, but the option to go out and look at longer terms, maybe invest more heavily in corporate securities if that was appropriate for that kind of instrument. For instance, the Dash 3s are relating to the damaged monies. It's set up as an endowment. There's no reason that we wouldn't be able to go out and take on some longer term. We have no risk of principal loss there. And it makes sense that those monies be able to be discreetly invested. I think there's about $16 million, so it's a sizable enough amount that we can, you know, that we can mess with it. Some of the funds are just not big enough that we can afford to mess with. And so it allows us, for those that you believe we should look at the potential of discreetly investing, it'll allow us to, one, be assured that you've had the policy discussion with the agency that you believe it's appropriate that we consider that, and then we'll have the discussion with the agency based on the uses of funds and the treasurer's discretion on whether or not we feel it's appropriate to actually go out and invest longer term. And if not, it'll continue to stay in the short-term fund and earn interest just like it does currently.
Okay.
It doesn't have any impact on any bills that we on any funds currently under management. All of we follow this distinction is in our policy and practice now, and this doesn't change that. And relative to the various accounts that are being removed from the general fund, this bill has no substantive impact on the programs. All the agencies have been consulted and have no issue with these changes. So
does the original bill then essentially just codify your existing practices?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Other questions on Senate Bill 66, Dash 1s, Dash 2s, or the Dash 3s?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Stark.
Is it your intention to move the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s? Or is one substitute for the other?
No, I believe you would need... The request is that we would adopt all three. The ones deal just with the issue that Secretary of State Bradbury and right. Treasurer Edwards...
Those I understand.
The 2s and the 3s, and... Darren, you're going to get some exercise this morning. I believe catch things that he did not give in his original bill.
Senator Starr, the 2s catch 2 accounts that are in the general fund and remove them like the original bill removes those accounts from the general fund, and I simply missed those when we drafted the bill. And again, I apologize. The Dash 3s are actually proposed by DHS, and they will, taking advantage of the investment interest distinction that we're making in the bill, that will create investment language in the statutes that set up those damage funds, and I can't remember exactly the name of that account, and allow those monies to be invested discreetly.
Senator George.
I know this question is going to sound silly, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and that is, because these are such predictable amounts, and because we're going to move them out of the general fund, if they had remained in the general fund because of the stability of them, in other words, you know almost exactly what's going to be accruing in way of interest, it wouldn't in any way impact the kicker calculation. Is that correct? Best you could tell?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, no, because these revenues accrue directly to the account and not to the general fund in general. So these would not be calculated and would be included in the kicker calculation.
So they've been outside, they're considered outside already?
For all intents and purposes, they are outside the general fund. Right. And so the complicating factor is having to report on them, sometimes as if they were and sometimes as if they're not.
Some bills that are coming, that's a very good question in terms of the kicker calculation. Not this one, from what Mr. Bond. Other questions on Senate Bill 66, the ones, the twos, or the dash threes? Thank you. Close the public hearing. And we'll open a work session, and if the committee, we could adopt the 1, 2s, and 3s and reschedule this for next week if folks just kind of want to look it over. The folks on my right seem ready to go. My left, I'm happy to reschedule this. Open a work session on Senate Bill 66. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the amendments dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3 to Senate Bill 66, and this will not go to Ways and Means, it'll go to the floor.
That is correct.
And then move it to the floor.
Can we do three amendments? We are.
Just one at a time?
One at a time.
Dash 1.
We are. What's the stream like?
So much for being efficient.
We did it with our LCs. I like this expedited. Okay, Senator George has moved the dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 66. Any discussion on the dash 1? Any objections? So ordered. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 66.
Senator George has moved the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 66. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 66-3 be added to the bill.
Senator George is now adding the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 66. Discussion on the dash 3. Objections to the dash 3. So ordered. Senator George.
Move Senate Bill 66 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended with dash 1, 2, and 3.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 66 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the amendments 1 through 3 in them. Discussion of that motion. Objections to that motion. So ordered. Senator George, would you like to carry that bill? Great. Done with Senate Bill 66, Madison. Thanks for running down here.
Do you want to be able to do this, Mr. Chair?
What do you do? I think I got it.
All right.
I'm getting nods. We're all gaveled through.
Thank you. My first bill of the session, Mr. Chair.
Oh, good. Good. Well,
this needs a
celebration.
Yes.
This is the hookah shop.
Did we get that on that? Did we get that one on tape? Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 416, and we'll let Senator Walker come up, and Mary will introduce the bill, and I know you have a busy schedule, so we'll work with you to go fast. Mary.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 416 limits the historical property special assessments to one 15-year term for all types of property, however, permits completion of the second 15-year term of special assessment. As a very brief background, let me say that under current law, and until 2005, all commercial properties that were historically designated were eligible for the first and the second period of special assessment if they reapplied and were approved subject to certain conditions they had to fulfill with the historical with the Historical Preservation Officer. In 2005, the legislature enacted a bill to allow residential historically designated properties to have the second 15-year term if it was approved by local decisions. I've been told that since 2005, we've got about 2,400 historically designated properties, about 600 are residential, and they're enrolled in their 15-year initial terms of a special assessment. 5 have reapplied for a second term. 17 cities and 2 counties have approved the second 15-year period of special assessment.
State Senator Vicki Walker from Eugene.
Thank you, Mr. Decker, or Senator Deckers. I appreciate that you've made my introduction because I often forget it myself. I appreciate that you are hearing this bill because it comes to you after you heard it last session in House Bill 2776. And I went through the testimony in both the House and the Senate from last session on this bill, and you were a little bit irritated that that the State Historic Preservation Office had not come forward with some of their ideas and comments about the bill until it got over to the Senate. So they all got together and came up with another amendment. But what was shocking to me is that I co-sponsored that bill. And every member of the Senate, except 2, who were excused, voted on it. There were some no votes in the House. And at the time, I probably didn't know what I was doing because, and I'll freely admit that, because obviously I'm pretty upset about what we did. There were a series of articles by both the Oregonian and Willamette Week. Oregonian was in November of 2005, and the Willamette Week article was January of 2006. I've given those articles to all of you prior to the hearing. And when I read those articles, I wrote a note to myself, and it's still right here, take to Capitol, ask LC to do bill, because I couldn't believe that we would allow a bill like that. So imagine my embarrassment when I looked at the bill and found out that I had supported it. So I say that I probably didn't know what I was doing because I didn't realize the detail that was missing. I wasn't in the committee, so I went off of what was given to me on a staff measure summary and what I saw in the bill. But what these articles point out is that we have a serious problem in our historic preservation statute. Prior to 1995, we didn't even require people to file a plan. That was freely admitted in the testimony last session, that prior to 1995, there was no requirement for a homeowner to make preservation repairs for the first 15 years. After 1995, there was a preservation plan put into place as part of the application process, and that testimony was by James Hamrick from the Oregon Departments of Parks and Rec. Well, I appreciate that they changed it in 95, but we still don't seem to be getting it right. Representative Andy Olson had asked in the hearing how the preservation plan is reviewed to ensure compliance, and the response was that there are built-in monitoring procedures and on-site inspections. They have authority to do those, and that there is supposed to be a monitoring assessment of the plan four times during the assessment period. Well, when I brought the department in, or they volunteered to come in and talk to me about this bill, they're very proud of the statute, and it actually is a good statute if we do it right, because we can preserve historic properties. And the department said this program has been around for over 30 years, and it has. And it has. But there's ambiguity, and the department admits there's ambiguity. There are no sideboards to what qualifies as preservation, what qualifies as maintenance. I'm serious. You can put a new roof on your historic property, and you can paint it, and that's that qualifies for this tax break under the program. Well, right now, I need a new roof on my home, and I talked to my husband last night, and we got an estimate, and it will be about $6,500 for a new roof. But nobody is giving me a tax credit to put a new roof on my home. And if you look at some of the properties, it's just outstanding that people would get such a tax break. For instance, in the Pearl District, owner, chief executive officer of Freightliner, CEO of Umpqua Bank, a former Nike executive, and 6 others have these row houses, these townhouses. Property taxes at a normal rate would be $9,000 per row house on average. The taxes they're paying? $137. The interior was largely gutted and remade with modern finishes. That isn't historic preservation. So I'm asking you, and I appreciate that you've allowed me to have this bill heard again, let's rethink this program. What are we doing for the second 15 years for residential property? And I will admit that the program is really important for commercial property because we ask for seismic upgrades. We ask for ADA accessible reconstruction, and they have tremendous sideboards for commercial property, but we don't have the same for residential. And I can't imagine what you can't get done in the first 15 years that you need to do in another 15 years and continue to get the tax break. Mr. Chair, the Susan Haylock was quoted in the Oregonian article. She's the state preservation specialist who decides whether to grant the tax break. She's quoted as saying she cannot recall the last time she turned down a formal application for the tax break, nor the last time Oregon repealed a tax break because an owner did too little to preserve the building. I say that we don't have enough sideboards. This is taxpayer money. In my community, they put a public safety measure on the ballot in the November election, and it lost. It went down. And they put it on the ballot because they don't have the money to fund programs. This program takes away money from the counties and the cities, and I'm not going to pass another measure asking for money from me until I get some accountability in the way we give out tax breaks. I have other bills that will deal with that, but particularly I just want to address this one. In the Willamette Week, they reported that the Oregonian said that in November, historic tax breaks cost Multnomah County about $6.5 million annually. That's a lot of money. Let's just have some accountability. The department came to me with some language. They actually said they prefer a tax credit based on the restoration work that's more accountable and easily maintained because you can drag things out and drag things out. They also came to me with some language that they would actually ask you to perform more of the substantial work in the first 5 years of your 15 years. And, you know, I'm willing to look at this, but I want really strict sideboards because the public is really angry at us for giving away all this money. And I understand why this program is valuable. I'm not disputing that. I just simply don't think that Rasheed Wallace should be living in a home. I'm not quite sure he lives in it anymore, but his home is valued at $4.5 million. His property taxes should be $43,000. He pays $15,700. I'd like to know what Mr. Wallace is doing in his home to restore it and preserve it in order to get that kind of a tax break. So I'm just asking for accountability, Senator. That's all.
Thank you. Senator George.
Senator, the preservation of historic buildings, for example, in a town that used to be part of my district, Newburgh, there are 180 historic homes that we need to preserve. They're expensive to maintain, and we want to help them. But on the same time, I agree with you that we need sideboards on this. Can you tell us a little bit about the other bills? Because I don't see anything in 416 that would do that.
Well, 416 just gets Mr. Chair and Senator George. 416 just says you can't have the additional 15 year, and it doesn't set up the sideboard. So this was just sort of an opening shot across the bow that says what we did was wrong. I think we need to revisit it. And I think a number of the sideboards are set up by administrative rule. We can certainly do them in statute, and I'm more than happy to put them in here. I mean, the other bills I referenced are just about tax breaks generally and how we just need more accountability. I don't think a tax break is bad necessarily. They can do good things, but there needs to be accountability for the tax break. And if you don't meet the requirements, then the money should be paid back. Because we're not a bank to just give away money freely.
Yeah, please.
Just to follow up, I would really like to see something in here indicating that is our feeling, that there should be substantial addition of sideboards to make sure that person, in other words, you may preserve the outer shell, but you've destroyed the interior part. If that was the case, then only, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you half of the tax break, would be my thought on that, because you only saved one half of that house, the outside. So if we could do something like that, I think that would be really wise to have it leave here with some instruction from the legislature saying, look, we want preservation in order to get this tax break. And if you're not going to do that, then we're going to have to consider as to whether or not we even issue this tax break.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I agree with you, and I'm hoping that you'll hear that conversation today. I don't think you had that conversation in the Senate. You didn't. I looked at the record because the bill came to you from the House, and a lot of times when the bill comes from the House, you assume it's been worked, everybody agrees to it, and we're ready to roll. I don't think those questions came up in the Senate. I know they didn't. A few of them did in the House. But I think this is a chance for us to open this back up and ask those questions and have people testify today about how we might protect the taxpayer and how we might set up some sideboards to ensure that this program works the way we expect it to.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume it would be within the spirit of what you're saying to also try to get a handle on the magnitude of the tax break. You talked about a situation with Rasheed Wallace where the taxes were should have been $43,000. Instead, they were $15,000. Well, I met a business person, wealthy business person, in the course of a campaign about a year ago who said that he had just sold his condominium in the Pearl for $1.2 million. And his taxes were $75 a year. And he was outraged. He said, my gosh, you know, they could have at least done $750. I mean, that was his reaction because he understood the impact on the city and on all local government of having that kind of magnitude of value versus tax. And so I guess, Mr. Chair, I would be very interested in looking at some way to put sideboards on the magnitude of the tax break in situations like the Pearl, which these are not needy people who live in these condominiums. And they lots of times these condominiums have just been gutted, and it's just a technicality. When people think of historic preservation, I don't think that they're thinking of the Pearl. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of hostility in Portland over that.
And I'm not sure if the city of Portland is here.
They are.
A couple years ago, this was really a great deal of discussion was around it's their money. This is obviously not its property tax, and so it's largely city and county money. And they, my understanding is, they have to agree. So that's it brings in an interesting facet of should we put sideboards on the city of Portland or Multnomah County? And I don't know if they're signed up to testify, but that was certainly the nature of the discussion last time. I'm happy to entertain it, Senator Burdick.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a couple points. I wouldn't want to go a route where any one city is singled out. I don't think that's the right way to go. And I also want to point out that the taxes that are paid by property tax, $5 of those taxes go effectively into the state school fund. And so it really is a matter of statewide interest, and I don't think any particular city should be. I think we should develop some good, reasonable policy without singling out a particular city.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, you are dead right on, because what they can't collect in their own communities, they come here with their hand out, mm-hmm. asking for money to help shore up their services. So if they're giving all the money away at home, I can't really fill that hand with money from state coffers. And Portland actually did not, Mr. Chair, Portland did not adopt the second 15-year extension at this time. They have not done that for residential. And I spoke with them yesterday about that, and they're concerned. So I just think if we can, apparently the department doesn't have enough sideboards to satisfy me, so maybe we can do it for them, and I'd love to hear their comments. I'm going to have to step out. I have a number of appointments, but my staff will remain in the room and take notes, and I'm happy to meet with folks, but clearly we need to sort of give some direction to communities about, well, if you're going to give away the money, you know, this is the impact it will have. Portland, for instance, can't even fund the Wapato Jail because, or that's Multnomah, yeah, I'm sorry, but that's a Portland area. Multnomah County cannot fund the jail. So, you know, let's take a look at the tax breaks they're giving away to allow people to live in expensive homes. And, you know, I'm not against the rich folks. They got rich for a reason. They apparently did better, and had better life circumstances than me. But, they also don't get all these freebies. And there are some folks who have actually done a lot of things and invested a lot of money. The article pointed that out, to refurbish the home and put it back, you know, putting period lighting, period floors, period walls, you know, even a tile roof that matched the house. And that kind of roofing is acceptable. That's preservation and historic properties. Senator George, you're right. Eugene, we got rid of almost all of our historic properties in urban renewal. I just can't tell you how sick it makes me that we have so few. We have some in South Eugene in the university neighborhoods and a few scattered about, but we tore out so many historical properties. And I love architecture. I mean, we heard yesterday, Senator Deckert, in our committee about the Lincoln School, the old Lincoln School on the Portland State University campus. It would be a travesty to tear that building down because it has value both architecturally and historically, and so I'm into this, but let's please just put some parameters around it.
Other questions for Senator Walker?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Interesting issue. We spent a great deal of time on urban renewal last session and passed a bill in the Senate that, but as you get into this, the cities and the counties, and Portland is certainly the has more urban renewal districts than any, and the effects it has, Senator Burdick, your point is it just affects all the other public services that a city or county can provide when you're very aggressive with property tax breaks or urban renewal. Here we go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'll scoot off and leave my staff here to take notes.
Next up, Roger Roper, Jim Myron, John Tess.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jim Myron, the legislative coordinator at State Parks. With me today is Roger Roper, who is our assistant director for heritage programs. We've got a short statement that I think most of the information in our statement was already covered by the committee administrator. We're here primarily to answer any questions about the existing program and to offer our support and assistance in your efforts to do whatever you feel is necessary with this program. So I'll ask Roger to make an opening statement.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we appreciate being here, and we appreciate Senator Walker's interest in this program. It's an important program. Actually, it's a landmark program in the country. When it was introduced in 76, it was state-of-the-art, and it's been an inspiration around the country. We're proud of that, and we want to continue to be proud of it, so we are interested in looking for improvements in the program. I do want to clarify some of the issues raised by the senator and explain some of the ways we do have sideboards in place. There is a preservation plan required of property owners. They have to do regular reporting back to us. Our staff have to approve changes that they propose for their building. There are annual open houses required of each property, and that provides some interesting inspection by neighbors and other residents of the community, and we get reports on violations from that alone. Many of the improvements as well that are made to these historic buildings are subject to local landmark commission review, so there is a layer of oversight at that level, and we are increasingly relying on those local eyes and that local expertise to help inform us as we make our judgment on appropriate activities.
Mr. Roberts,
yes.
Can I just say, because I'll forget if I don't. So all of these properties, and even the ones that were listed in Senator Walker's testimony, are required to have an open house annually?
Yes.
And how are they required to advertise that or let the community know that their home is open this Sunday for the day?
we promote that, and it actually gets picked up very well through the press. We do press releases on it, and it appears regularly in the Portland papers and other papers. It gets good coverage. We have listservs we distribute it on. And some communities plan a collective event around those. In a historic district, say, all the neighbors get together and they promote it as sort of a preservation awareness event.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt your flow.
Let's see. In terms of the standards, what is appropriate preservation? There are some well-defined standards. We use what's been adopted nationally, the Secretary of the Interior Standards for Rehabilitation, which includes restoration and rehabilitation work, as well as some maintenance items. And if you think about it, historic preservation, buildings are like antique furniture in a way, and you're better off not doing dramatic, disruptive restoration. You know, if you've watched Antiques Roadshow, an antique piece of furniture that's kept in original condition, even though it's a little dented, is more valuable than one that's been heavily restored. Same with the building. So we encourage the quiet improvements and maintenance along the way, so there doesn't have to be a dramatic, expensive rehabilitation later. But it's a balance that this program is about. Restore some things, keep it up so we don't have to face derelict buildings down the line. The Oregonian article and the Willamette Week article that came out were critical, and they hit a couple of sore points, but they got some things wrong, and the editorial board at the Oregonian reviewed that and came out with an editorial shortly thereafter, backing away from the premise, the main accusations of that article, and really supporting the intent of the program as a good incentive for economic development and preservation of history. So we know there are some flaws with the program. There have been some abuses. We've disqualified people. We do turn down applications. We have a fairly good system in place, and that doesn't mean some projects don't slip through the cracks, but by and large, I think we've been able to capture those. And just one other item for perspective, there are only about 70 projects a year that sign up for this, and there are many more that are eligible. So it's not a free-for-all for just anyone who wants to walk through the door. There's a filing fee that's required of them, the preservation plan. We have folks on one side who just give up because they can't come up with work that will meet our standards. Others complain that we're too loose. So we're getting complaints a little from both sides, but the vast majority of applicants fit very nicely into the program. We work something out, and they move forward with it. So there are some of the extremes that create more of the noise, but more often it's a pretty amicable process. Those are my comments. I'd be happy to answer any other questions. Mm-hmm.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Roper, you said that 2,200 historic buildings have benefited from this program over the years, and what is the remedy if someone doesn't comply with the requirement? They don't have their open house, or they don't comply with their preservation plan, or they don't comply in some way. What is the remedy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, once we find out there's been a violation, or we suspect one, we notify the property owner and start a communication to try to resolve that. We have ways of working with them if there are hardship issues, and we'll make on-site visits to verify issues, and eventually we do have a mechanism for throwing them out of the program. They would have to pay the back taxes plus a penalty, and that has happened in some cases.
How many cases, to follow up, Mr. Chair, how many out of the 2,200 have you actually revoked the certification?
I don't have an exact count of that right now.
We can get that for you.
We could track that down. Some of the early records in the beginning of the program aren't as accurate as the more recent ones, where we have a database and all of that. It's pretty rare. There was one this year that we revoked, and so they come along once in a while. But for the most part, the people involved with this are emotionally committed to this program and to the historic preservation. So we've got a largely good batch of folks, and there aren't that many bad apples.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I could just ask another question. How, because in the Pearl District in Northwest Portland, and I live in Portland, I used to actually represent the Pearl, so this isn't an anti-Pearl question, but how on earth do you get a circumstance could you just share how the process works where you could have a $1.2 million condominium paying $75 a year in tax?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I can't explain that. That sounds wrong to me based on the kinds of projects we see. I think if we really looked into that, that it may not turn out that way. There are other, Portland has some other property tax relief programs, and it could be that it's compounded with those. But typically that would not stand up in our program. I guess we haven't seen that sort of disparity.
Yeah, and I will confess to being confused myself because, you know, looking into this, there's the urban renewal aspect of it. There's a historic, but I was under the impression that this was primarily a historic preservation issue, and I could be wrong on that, so I will look.
We'd be happy to research that if we had some specifics on it.
Okay, maybe the city of Portland is here, so maybe the two of you can collaborate to find an answer to this question, because in the case of, and it could be this, none of it's historic preservation, but I would just want to know, because that's a particularly strong example of what is making people concerned about this program.
So just on that, and then we'll go to Senator George. One of the comments that you made, not knowing but just agree on instinct, is that the folks that are involved in this program care deeply. You call them the good apples or something to that, and that would be my guess too. Why do they need a tax break to take care of? They care about these properties. At least some of the information indicates they're relatively affluent. And so why do they need a tax break to do what they might otherwise just be inclined because of who they are and the good nature and the values that they have to incent them to do something that they might otherwise do?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, good question. And there are a lot of people who fit into that category who simply don't apply. That's why we only get 70 applicants per year. Part of it, the reason the incentive is there is because these buildings feature oftentimes archaic materials that require extra care, extra craftsmanship, hard-to-find parts. There are seismic issues, electrical upgrades, plumbing upgrades, and they have to meet a little higher standard if they're going to get this benefit. So it helps cover some of that cost of the added the added costs because of those features. But again, since there's a filing fee up front, that's a disincentive for some folks. They just feel like, you know, at the end of the day, I may not benefit enough in tax savings to have covered my filing fee and the hassle
of all
this.
How much is the filing fee?
It's 0.3% of the real market value.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is so critical that we keep this in balance, and that's why I don't feel so guilty about our vote last time. And here's the equation. You just articulated some of the things. This is a very expensive facility to maintain. Many states, on my understanding, and particularly some foreign countries, actually subsidize a person to maintain that if they're not able to. In other words, if you have a need, a person wants to stay in their beautiful old home that's been in their family, they can't do it, actually. You know, government agencies come in and help them to maintain that in that pristine state of preservation. So my concern is here that we not have that occur to where we're losing these. And I want to go back to Newburgh again because it's one we've been focused on. The Willamette Valley bicycle green path that's being planned, we've been working on that being brought into Newburgh over a historic bridge, by the way, which will be unbelievable. Part of the thing that was an interest to Oregon State Parks relative to the bicycle thing was the 180-plus homes. And during the meeting there, we had Don Clements of Shehalem Park and Rec talk about the restoration that they're doing right now, preserving a very, very historic building and moving it over actually into a cluster. And I see the head nodding. You know what I'm talking about. And even though this is a very expensive thing to do, and Park and Rec probably won't be asking for money from you, but the main thing is that that needs to occur. Because as we're talking about international tourists that are going to be coming into Oregon, who are now coming into Oregon, what do we go to Europe for? To look at old buildings. I think we better have that in our portfolio of things to do in Oregon. And what I'm understanding is the new generation of bicycle tourists are not some guy on a cheap bike, but somebody with a lot of money who will spend it in your community if you give them things that they can do when they're touring Oregon on a bike. So I think it's in our interest to make sure that we have enough incentive to preserve those. Could you comment on that? Am I too generous with government money?
Mr. Chair, Senator George.
No, I'll answer that.
Amen to everything he said. And there are some other incentive programs that are available. You know, there is a federal tax credit program for certain commercial properties. There are some grants oftentimes available. But they're not. There's not a lot available. And most people who have an old building and start looking around for that pot of money that they've heard come away a little disappointed that it's a little here and a little there, and they have to work for it. They can't. There's just no easy handout. So there are incentives, but they come at a little bit of a price, and we have to be careful how we dole those out.
I'm wondering if one of the criteria when determining whether or not somebody gets this tax break is that whether or not that property is in danger. In other words, without the tax, do you consider that without the tax break, this property may in fact be in danger? Is that a criteria at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, no, it is not at this time.
Well, see, that's what bothers me, because a lot of the big old mansions in Dunthorpe, for example, and I've campaigned through Dunthorpe and I've biked through Dunthorpe, and there's multi-million dollar mansions that people have a tremendous investment in, which I wouldn't imagine are in any danger at all. I mean, it would be stupid for somebody to let them get run down. These are people that have huge incomes, or they couldn't afford to live in a $4, $5, $6, $10 million home. You know, and yet some of them are getting this tax break and paying very little property tax at all. When, you know, sure, they're historic buildings, they're beautiful old mansions that may be 100 years old, but they're not in any danger. So why should we be giving these people a huge tax break?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I agree. That doesn't sound fair. Part of it, though, is I would think that it's difficult to wait until something is really threatened and then to be able to step in at the 11th hour and save it. And so some of this is to do upfront work to prevent things from getting to the point where it would ever cross that line. Zoning issues are a challenge oftentimes, where you get residential properties that get shifted into some sort of commercial zone, and suddenly they're very threatened. I'm not sure if a state statute can be as nimble as would be required to address all the local issues and impacts that might create threats or otherwise. So, but I think it's a worthy thought of, you know, why hand out to the wealthy, but.
Could your office deny that application based on if an application is sent in based on some sort of in danger, looking at the neighborhood around and saying, no, this is valuable real estate, a valuable community, and not in danger of being run down?
Mr. Chair, currently, no. Neither the statute nor the rules allow that as a criteria for acceptance. It's more, what are they doing appropriate work in their preservation plan? That's the criteria.
So perhaps that's that might be, that seems like might make sense to put some sort of statutory change there that says, is this actually in danger of not being in decent shape? Senator Brewster.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is related to the application fee that you mentioned, one-third and 1% of real market value. So a $1.2 million home, their application fee would be $4,000. Is that refundable, or is, you know, the person writes the check and rolls the dice and hopes that they get the tax break?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we work with them beforehand so that they're pretty confident that what they're coming together with in their preservation plan would be legitimate and acceptable, and then we get the check. Once they're in, they're in, and if they back out, you know, they've lost their money.
So, Mr. Chair, just follow up. So the application fee, they know pretty well going in whether or not they're going to get the tax break before they write the check.
Usually. We think that's just good customer service to advise them and work with them. They often come in with ideas that aren't quite sound for what should be in the plan. So there's a fair amount of hand-holding, especially with the homeowners who don't have a professional architect or contractor on staff. And so we do work with them a lot, and they usually enter knowing what the outcome will probably be.
Mr. Chair, then I would submit that the application fee, contrary to your testimony, really wouldn't be an impediment to the program, because you know $4,000 fee on a $1.2 million home, and we had examples of property tax bills that are in the hundreds of dollars, significant savings over 15 years. So I'm with the majority in the committee that thinks that this is an important program, but we ought to be more thoughtful, perhaps.
It seems to me if they know that they're going to, if they can bank on the 15 years or now even more than that, and they know that it's $4,300 on that example, why I just couldn't imagine myself not availing myself of that option. Other questions? We've got a couple other folks to testify. We have piqued this committee's interest, probably in a way that you had hoped not, but...
well, just one other...
Yeah, please.
It seems like, in recollection, I've done some contracting work in homes that are on the historic register. Isn't there a requirement that these homes be opened to the public a certain amount during a year? Maybe that testimony was already given and I missed it.
Yeah, one day a year.
One day.
Thank you.
Mr. Tess, if y'all could stay, just in case, okay. He might bring up something and you have more authority than...
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is John Tess. I'm here today representing the Oregon Historic Property Owners Association. It's basically a grassroots group of private historic property owners that are interested in preservation of Oregon's built environment. We've been here many, many times since 1975, you know, because this bill has been probably looked at more than any other bill in the world in terms of people having interest, at least for me. Just to kind of give you some background on myself so you know where I'm coming from, I'm a preservation consultant. I've been in business for 25 years. I have an office in Portland and one in Philadelphia. I do work all over the country. In my prior life, I've worked for the SHPO office, and I was the first administrator of the special assessment tax law, and so I'm pretty familiar with that. I also, Senator George, have 14 bicycles, so I know what you mean about people who like to tour the state. To begin, I'd like to say thank you, Senator Walker, and everybody, and you know, with their interest in the bill. And I think that you know everybody is interested in this bill as much as they're interested in you know Oregon and our built environment and why people like to live here and why we are the way we are. I travel all over the United States, and you know this. Everybody goes. You know, first they thought when I was in business, you know, why do you live out there? You have to take a wagon train to get to civilization and get an airplane, and then, you know, you finally get here. Why should we hire you? But we've gotten past that, and people are coming here. And part of it, I think, it is because of, you know, what we've saved. I think Senator George pointed out quite rightly that tourism is a very big thing, and people come here, and they come here to see Oregon. When you're downtown, you have a sense of, you know, it's a livable place. And now with all this new urbanism coming into play and people coming downtown, there's an incredible amount of pressure being put on our historic properties, not only in the Portland area, but also in places like Newburgh, places like Hood River, places like Baker. I was looking at a place in Halfway, you know, and then looking at some of the prices on properties throughout the state. It's just incredible. But more and more pressure is being put on our historic buildings. Oregon's tax law really was a leader in when it was put into place in 1975, and it was in response to people tearing down historic buildings. And the law has worked very, very successfully in terms of acting as a deterrent, and it's a carrot rather than a stick, to, you know, and that's what I think that we need here, and I think that, you know, we need to enhance this bill and need to keep the bill where it is. Senator Burdick brought up a question of how can a property get so much more value in the Pearl District or some other, it could be anywhere, it doesn't necessarily need to be just in the Pearl District. One of the things that's happening throughout the state is that developers are coming into towns. They see these small buildings, two, three, four-story buildings. They find out that the FAR and the buildability, you can put a 20-story building there. Doesn't take brain surgery to say, what should we do here? Should we keep the four- or five-story building, or should we tear it down and put up a new building and sell these condominiums for what they are? In 1984, when the 13th Avenue Historic District was formed, that area was nowhere near what it is today. I mean, basically, it was train yards. And they weren't sure they were going to tear those buildings down. It was a warehousing district. I had done the nomination on it. People were asking, why are you designating these warehouse buildings and making these buildings historic? And now people, it really was the impetus for, you know, what's going on in the Pearl. So what happens is that someone comes in and they say, okay, you look at the Honeyman Warehouse loft. Not the Honeyman, but there's the Irving Street lofts. The building was an empty building, vacant. Warehousing had gone out of the upper floors. And someone's willing to come in and invest a lot of money down there. There had not been any housing in that area at all. And so they invest the money, and the building, yes, it's assessed at a low value. And then as a new development comes in, it did exactly what it was supposed to do, caused economic development. It did exactly, you know, it pays back in different ways. You give a tax break, fine. It happens all over. I mean, if you were looking at urban development the other day, I mean, you know, you give tax incentives. They work well to enhance things. And that's how you would get to a value of a property. It was because of the development that occurred around, and then that property, in fact, increased in value. The other thing that the law does is it saves neighborhoods. If you look at the Corbett Terwilliger neighborhood, Southwater, the urban renewal had initially taken down a lot of that neighborhood that was a Jewish neighborhood, an Italian neighborhood, and that was taken down when the towers were put up, but you still have the Corbett, Lair Hill area. Those areas are saved. That's a historic district. You have Ladd's Addition. And what this, when you buy into this law, what you're really doing is you're buying into design review. And it's amazing, as Roger said, the amount of money that people put into these properties. I used to live in Ladd's Addition. I lived in a historic house. And we ended up putting, real wood windows, not aluminum windows in. We put a real wood storm door in. I mean, there was a lot more money expended on that property. And if we got, the little bit of a tax break that helped us bridge that gap, I mean, it was worth it to, I think, the entire community. People love to go in Portland's neighborhoods, throughout the city and look at those neighborhoods. Yes, as Senator Monroe said, sometimes you're going to have expensive properties that take advantage of this. These guys are putting themselves under design review from this office, and a lot of guys won't choose to do that. They get to look at your interior as well as your exterior. You're redoing your kitchen, they're looking at it. You're redoing, a roof on your house, you may end up having to put a cedar roof on instead of putting an asphalt roof on. So the cost of maintaining a historic building is really a lot more. And we always fail. You say we're giving people a tax break. Well, a tax break, if you look at all the tax preference items that are available in the state, this is less than 1%. And this gives back to the community. There's been studies done. I believe there's a study that the SHPO office did a number of years ago and shows what goes back into this. In terms of the reapplication for the 15 years, I sat on a seismic task force that was put together by the governor a number of years ago, and we literally came down here 40 times and had about 30 other meetings. I mean, we had a lot of meetings on this, and what came out of it is that, seismic code being upgraded, just regular codes on, life safety code and energy code was a reason to give a second 15 years, as well as maintenance, because they realized that as law was first enacted, it was to maintain you had to maintain the property, and that was put back into place. It seems that the focus on this is mostly on the residential as opposed to the commercial properties. I think it's worked well with the commercial properties. I think that if you look at our cities, you're going to find that the the program has not been abused. When it is abused, I think the State Historic Preservation Office and the preservation community as a whole has done a good job in policing that. And you may find that there haven't been a lot of properties taken off of special assessment. I think one of the reasons is that, A, people who find out about the program find out that you're going to be looking at my kitchen and my bathroom and other things, don't even come on to the program, so it has kind of a self-regulating, you know, whether you're on the program or not. And then secondly is that I think that people are able to work out, you know, issues with the SHPO office, and they're very good at working out those issues and main, you know, getting to a point where it makes sense. I think that, as Senator Walker has said, that she kind of threw this out here to open a discussion, which she has opened a discussion, and I don't want to take up all your time today, but I, for one, have sat on a task force and work groups with respect to this, and I would be very happy to sit on a work group with the senator and with the SHPO office, and I think there's other people, too, that, you know, maybe do that and then come back, you know, with some responses to some of the issues that have been raised here.
Thank you.
I'll stop. I can talk all day about this stuff.
We appreciate your concern and obviously the work that folks have done to keep the built world in Oregon is. I don't think there's any disagreement as to that. It's just are we focused and do we have the right impediments in place to keep some of these examples out? And you, Mr. Roper, you were going to get us, but you just didn't have it at your fingertips here, examples of folks, the self-policing aspect of folks that you've taken out of the program, correct?
Yes.
So we'll get that. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're the representative of the Historic Homeowners Association. Do you live in a historic home yourself?
I used to. I do not now. The house that I live in could, in fact, be made historic, but I choose not to do that.
And why do you choose not to?
Because I like to remodel my house the way I like to remodel it.
Mr. Chair, where do you keep your 14 bikes?
Mm-hmm. Well, I try to keep them out of sight of my wife, and I keep some at the office, and I keep, you know, just keep them kind of moving. I try to buy the same colors so she doesn't know that when I change them. So, but I used to own a bike store.
Senator Burdick's going to try to get in on one or two of them.
On a serious note, Mr. Chair, you did talk about the Pearl, and so if you have any insight to add to my question about how those property tax breaks turned out the way they did in the Pearl, I'd be happy if you could share it with the City of Portland, Mr. Roper, or whoever, so we can kind of get an answer to that.
I'd be happy to give you an example of how it worked and what you could have done and how it got that way.
Because, you know, in the Pearl, because those are new places, you really can't make the same argument that people are going to be buying roofs and replumbing and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and we looked at, well, I think the City of Portland should do it. Not they should. A couple years ago, they came in and showed just in the Pearl how they won after the other in terms of county and city. It's all property tax. I'm not aware of any income tax incentives at all that were utilized. But there was seemed to be three or four. Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your passion. I think that's terrific. The question that I would ask is, 15-year, I don't think there's a lot of discussion or debate about the value of maybe a 15-year break, but extending that to an additional 15 years, I think that's part of our, you know, the question here. Does it make sense after the initial break to, you know, to continue this, you know, for create a 30-year program?
Well, what happens really is that once you're off the program, if you're going to reapply, you get reassessed. So you're not really starting at your point one. You're brought back up to value. In fact, you're kind of penalized because normally you would have just gone up 3% per year. And if you actually have to be reassessed, you may in fact be in a worse situation than had you just not gone on to the special assessment program. In terms of commercial buildings and you being a developer, you know that tenant improvements and, you know, building things have a useful life. It seems to be, you know, 20 20 years seems to be a number that, you know, you kind of see things happen and things get turned around. So I think a second 15 years is legitimate. I think that I agree with all of you that, you know, these perimeters maybe need to be looked at a little bit more and then tweaked a little bit.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Pazer, we are at the hour here, and members need to depart. Did you want to address this today or the next? We are, I believe there's, the committee would like to.
I would appreciate a few minutes.
Please, come on up and.
Mr. Chairman, while he's coming up, could we get some additional information on the Pearl? Because a friend of mine just attended a meeting back, I believe it was in Chicago, and that Pearl project and what has happened in that redevelopment was almost the focus of an international meeting of a great success story. So I'd kind of like to find out where we are relative to what's happened in Pearl and whether it is a negative thing or whether it's a very positive thing.
Yeah. Very, that's a big discussion. Mr. Roper, though, it would be helpful to get more information on where the properties are statewide, where they're located. Just, I think on this one, just getting a little more information would be really helpful as quickly as we could get it. We'll try to put this back on the agenda next week. Okay, Mr. Pazer, sorry that we got you late. Good morning.
Hi, my name is Steve Poyser.
Poyser.
P-O-Y-S-E-R. And I'm representing the Oregon Preservation Alliance, which is a statewide nonprofit preservation advocacy group. It's a grassroots group. Our board members come from Eastern Oregon, Central Oregon, the West, the Portland area. So we truly are a grassroots organization. I'm somewhat concerned by some of the comments this morning, just for clarification, and Mr. Test just mentioned this, and I want to reiterate it. The $75 in taxes, if a building is assessed at $75, that's not Chappelle's fault. It's the tax assessor's fault. So it goes in the program at the assessed value. Again, the property is reassessed at the end of the 15-year period. So whatever the increased value is what it's reassessed at for the second term. And also, as Mr. Test said, there is a 3% cap on how much taxes can rise during that period. So obviously, they would be in a disadvantage if they'd been going through the 15-year assessment, you know, at 3%. So you need to keep that in mind. But my concern here is talking about the value of special assessment and what it means for the entire community and for the state as a whole. Special assessment not only benefits the homeowner, it benefits the community because it provides an incentive for people who live in the community to look at their properties and see how they can benefit from special assessment indirectly. It's often a catalyst for other people in the neighborhood to improve their homes. And indirectly, that increases the tax base for the community itself. So you need to keep that in mind. It also helps the community promote a sense of identity. People recognize these resources as being symbolic of their neighborhood and of their community. And it instills community pride. That's an indirect benefit. How do you put a dollar figure on that? Also, it's an economic development tool because it makes people want to move into the community and enhance that and bring business in other homes in the community. So there's a lot of benefits to this program besides the few individuals who are benefiting from this. And by all means, this program just doesn't happen in Portland. It happens throughout the state. So people look to preservation as an incentive and as a hope for increasing the value of their property and for the economic value of the whole state. I can go on, but I'm not going to. Anyway, thank you very much for your time. Any questions?
Thank you. I think you heard it from the committee. We agree with everything that you said in terms of the value and statewide nature and the pride you have as an Oregonian as you go through Jacksonville or NC or Newburgh.
Or Baker City.
Or Baker City. And so I think the things that we would consider would be some of the sideboards that we'll ask to have drafted, and then we'll post it 72 hours or at least 48 hours in advance, and appreciate your willingness to come down here and talk about a very valuable program for Oregon.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Questions, comments, relate? We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 416 and adjourn until Monday at 8:45.